Good morning.
Good morning.
So, I want to talk a little bit about history and a little bit about canons, which I know are not everyone's favorite topic, and a little bit about something we're going to do for the next couple of weeks. If you go way back in history, to the early medieval period or just before, so say year 700 or thereabouts, marriage happened very differently back then, and depending on who you were, you might just sort of move in with your spouse and then you were married and spent the rest of your lives more or less together, although back then there was a far higher probability that one of you would die at an early age than there usually is now. Antibiotics were a wonderful thing. And eventually people started to realize that it is helpful if there's a record, especially when you start talking about property and who inherits what. It's useful to know how people are related, which means that it's nice if you have a record of who got married and what kids they had. And as time was going on, it turned out that the people who could write things down and keep records really well tended to work for the church. This was for two reasons. One, people in the church had sort of the time and ability to learn how to read and write. This was long before everyone did that. And two, churches were fairly stable things. The closest church, the records wouldn't disappear with the priest or, you know, get lost in a trunk somewhere. They'd be kept and passed on to the next priest and so on through history. So you could go back and look up what had happened before people really accurately remembered something or could agree on something. This is how marriage started to move into the church. People needed a record, so we started recording them. And this is really sort of the murky beginnings of what we call the sacrament of marriage now. However, we're also talking about back long before there were other public records, because the church is some of the first people who do that. So if you wanted to get married to someone, everyone sort of wanted to make sure that you weren't too closely related or that one of you hadn't been married in the next town over but had sort of forgotten to mention it when you moved here. It used to be easier to like wipe the slate clean and start over. You just had to move far enough away. It's harder now. So the church developed a practice. And it's not one we continue quite as much anymore, mostly because there are other people who keep public records and we let them sort a lot of that out. But if you go back to older prayer books, you'll find that most of what they had to say about marriage was a reminder of who you could and couldn't marry. Pool tables of people you couldn't marry and how these relationships would work. If you look up the marriage canon today, it still references this, but we sort of point to a law that says how this works and say we just have to follow that. But how it used to happen was if you wanted to get married, you'd go to the priest, and then the priest would announce that for a few weeks, and they were called the banns of marriage. Today, if you remember when I got married, we didn't do that because I went and got a marriage license, and that sort of counts the same because it's the state doing that check instead of the local community. However, our marriage canon still offers this. The minister shall not solemnize a marriage unless the parties have obtained a license from the proper authority, or unless the banns have been published in conformity with civil law and in the manner required by Section 7. In Section 7, it continues, when the banns are to be published, they shall be called in the church 3 Sundays during divine worship after the accustomed manner and in conformity with the requirements of civil law. Where either or both of the parties are accustomed to worship in a church or churches other than their own parish church, the banns may be called in the church or churches in which they worship, provided that the civil law allows such procedure. And there's some more details, but that's sort of the relevant part for us. Now, in a lot of years of going to church, I don't think I've ever really seen this happen much, But we have a couple who are not getting married here, and the church they are getting married in requires that we read the banns of marriage for them. So we will do this, and the next couple Sundays we'll probably put it in at the beginning of the announcements, but because we've just talked about it a bit so that you have some understanding of why we do this and where it comes from historically, because I think that's cool. You might have all just dozed off. I understand. But if you would pay attention now, because this is the part that involves us as their place of worship. I am required to ask anyone present who knows a reason why these persons, Michael Ronald Sinoga and Jennifer Joanne Hutton, may not lawfully marry, to declare it now or forever hold your peace. Okay. That's it. They're very happy nobody jumped up right then. That's what I have this morning. Those of you who know your ancient history will remember the Phoenicians, of course. Everyone nods as if that's a common thing here, except none of you really do, because they don't exist on any current map. And their most famous city got burned and salted by Rome. The Phoenicians were travelers and traders of the ancient world. Before King David came onto the throne of Israel, the people just north of him had been all across the Mediterranean Sea. They established Carthage, the city that is famous for Rome's destruction of it. They had traded with Egypt and with Greece. They had seen the southern shores of Spain. They had gone everywhere in the world that they could find. But if you remember the stories we hold dear in our tradition, you'll remember that there's no stories of Israel's great trading trips, no stories of building ships, well, Noah, but not trading ships, not traveling ships. People who know more about this than I do tell me that the beginning of the sea by what we call Israel is too shallow for a good port in the ancient world. So they didn't venture into the seas. In fact, they often found the sea to be threatening, full of chaos and mystery. And if you ventured there, you were likely to die. Or if you're running away from God, get swallowed by a giant fish. Things did not go well, usually, when you went to sea. Water, the thing the sea is full of, was threatening and inimical. It could take your life so easily. But we have to remember these were also a desert people, nomads. And if we remember the stories we have been told for decades, we know that as the patriarchs wandered across this land God had promised them, they would build wells where they had encountered God often. That water, as threatening and dangerous as it could be, was also a sign of a promise kept, that they could live in a land that did not always like them either. If you study liturgics, scholars will go on at length with how we have asked baptism to happen. Ancient sources ask that it be running water and cold. This is how they define the living water that we are promised in Jesus. That it's active, that it's alive. And scholars will tell you that to baptize someone, what you really should have is enough water to drown in. That in baptism, we are caught up in this promise of death and life, that we remember that what holds for us the promise of a God who loves us also holds the promise that it can take our life away even still. That we remember that living water is not always safe. This morning we have heard the story of how Israel quarreled in the desert yet again. How after being rescued from Egypt's army and led safely through the sea, how after food and meat has been provided, they are still convinced they could die on this journey. We have seen that God will even bring water from the rock to sustain God's people. And this morning, Jesus has sat at a well and talked with someone he shouldn't have been talking with, because she was a woman, because she was a Samaritan. This shouldn't have happened. And it started out about water in the well and a drink, and it became about something so much greater and so much more lasting than a cool drink on a hot afternoon. It became about living water and what we are promised when we travel with Jesus. Not that it will be easy, not that we will always understand it, not that it will make sense. It often doesn't make sense. Not that we won't quarrel like the people of God did before water came out of the rock. Not that it won't threaten our lives, and so many of our stories of saints remind us, taking up this journey, traveling with Jesus, can still threaten your very life. But what we are promised, what Jesus offers the Samaritan, what Jesus offers his disciples, who are remarkably hapless in this story, what God offers the people through Moses and the rock is a refreshing drink at the end of a long journey. Yes. It's the promise that the journey can continue to go on. That what happens to us here and now is one part of a much grander story that we have been told and we will continue to tell. But it is also, and ultimately, this: that we don't need to build wells to find the water that God promises us, that we don't need the special staff and the rock that has been appointed, that somehow, in entering into this journey with Jesus, through our baptism and through the continued stories we remind each other of, we have the opportunity to become water for a thirsty world. That when people are lost and quarreling, when they are sure they can never fit in here, our job is to find the drink that will reassure them. The promise of love, so often carried in water in our stories, that God is with us, and that when it is scary, it does not mean that we are alone. But when we are convinced our lives and our faith are threatened, we are still carried by the promise God has made to us through the waters of our baptism, that we are, each and every one of us, the beloved child of God, with whom God is so very well pleased. Amen.